Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. What a beautiful day it is. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on White Rose Society. .org and radiopower.org, podcasting from whiterosesociety.org, as well as from Apple iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Melanie Sloan serves as CREW's executive director. CREW is the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. CREW targets government officials who sacrifice the common good to special interests, have been at the forefront of outing Tom DeLay for his dirty tricks, his ethical lapses, shall we say. Melanie, one of the people who really put this on the map. She has served as Assistant United States Attorney in the District of Columbia, where from 1998 to 2003, she successfully tried cases before dozens of judges and juries. And before becoming a prosecutor, she was minority counsel for the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee from 95 to 98. That was when Ruth Bader Ginsburg came before that committee, wasn't it?
That was actually a little earlier. And then I worked for the Senate Judiciary Committee then, and I worked on her nomination, actually, yes.
Great. So you've been on the inside of a lot of different things. Melanie, by the way, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. First of all, what's up with Tom DeLay?
What's up with Tom DeLay is that he's continuing on his merry way, and so far the Ethics Committee isn't doing a darn thing about it.
And why would that be? Might that have something to do with Doc Hastings having been put in, the good buddy of Tom DeLay's as chairman of the Ethics Committee?
Yes. I mean, well, last year they dumped several members of the Ethics Committee, including the chairman, Joel Heffley, because Tom DeLay thought that they had been too hard on him in the past for his reprehensible conduct, even though it had been unanimous decisions by the Ethics Committee. And so now the Ethics Committee says that they're going to investigate Tom DeLay, but they've been saying that for, 6 months now, and we don't see anything happening.
What is it going to take to make something happen?
What it would take to force something to happen is somebody would have to file an ethics complaint against Tom DeLay. And here's the problem. Outsiders, meaning people who are not members of Congress, cannot file ethics complaints. There's a rule that only other members can file. And for many years now, about 8 years, there's been a truce whereby both sides have said that they won't file a complaint against a member of the other party. That truce has been broken only a couple of times, and mainly when former Representative Chris Bell from Texas filed the complaint that we wrote for him against Tom DeLay last year. And Bell did that because he was actually on his way out. He was leaving Congress. And so he didn't have so much to fear. But everybody else is too afraid to file an ethics complaint. So even though that was allegedly breaking the truce seems to be, back up and running.
Well, there's an election next year. Is there not at least one Democrat who's retiring and, voluntarily from the House of Representatives, or an ethical Republican who would be willing to do this?
Not so far, but, I keep hoping that as we get a little closer to the election, people will retire or they'll lose their primaries, and perhaps then they will actually be willing to file the ethics complaint, because otherwise no one seems to be willing to do it.
Now, one who comes to mind is Bernie Sanders. Looks like he's going to be running for the Senate, so he'll be giving up his seat. Might that, of course, being in the Senate, he may need to keep his political power intact, as it were.
Right.
I don't know.
Anybody who's running for higher office won't file.
Yeah, the political calculus of this gets very complicated when you're dealing with somebody as powerful as Tom DeLay. How has this guy, this former bug killer from Texas, who from all outward appearances inhaled too much of his own product, how did he end up with so much power in the U.S. House of Representatives?
Well, it's a phrase that we've all been hearing since Watergate, follow the money. Tom DeLay is probably the best fundraiser ever in the House of Representatives, and he has managed to bring in enormous amounts of money for other members. He campaigns for them, and he collects tons of money, and when you are running every 2 years for your seat, you need a lot of money, and that's why he has such loyalty. He brings people money.
Is he continuing to, though? I understand, Melanie Sloan, that Cruz, executive director here, I understand that recently a number of corporations, American Airlines comes to mind, I don't recall the entire list, but a number of corporations have publicly said they're no longer going to give money to Tom DeLay.
Yes, there are a few who have said that, but you have to remember that Tom DeLay is still the majority leader, and that's an incredibly powerful position, and there are plenty of folks who are not going to want to jeopardize their relationship with the majority leader, and they're going to continue to give Tom DeLay money.
So nobody wants to say the king has no clothes, the emperor's wearing no clothes, or take on the king while he still has the ability to cut off their heads.
That's exactly right, because Tom DeLay is known to be a very vindictive person, and if he feels that somebody is mistreating him or some businesses are not, even before all this happened, there was a you-have-to-pay-to-play rule with Tom DeLay. If you wanted to get your legislation passed, you had darn well better be giving a lot of money to Republicans and not giving very much money to Democrats, and he actually keeps a book in his office of how much money everybody's giving, and if there's a problem with the amount, you know, they don't get their legislation.
Melanie Sloan, you're an attorney, are you not?
Yes, I am.
Is that not illegal?
Yes, that would be what we call extortion.
Yeah, it sounded familiar, you know?
Yes, and if we had a Justice Department with any guts at all, they would be investigating Tom DeLay for extortion and bribery. He has, you know, many cases where there are some pretty serious problems. We were lucky enough last year to learn the details regarding a case involving a company called Westar. And Westar is a Kansas energy company. And we got this rare insight into what was going on because a bunch of Westar emails became public. And some of those emails, one of the vice presidents said, you know, they were trying to get a piece of legislation passed on the energy bill. And they said, one executive said, this is how much money it's going to cost us. These are the donations we need to make in order to get that legislation. And one of the donations was to Tom DeLay. And somebody else wrote back, well, Tom DeLay, isn't he from Texas? What's our connection? You know, here we are, a Kansas energy company. And he got an email back saying, well, Tom DeLay is the majority leader, although he was actually the whip at the time, and nothing happens without his say-so, so we're going to have to make a contribution to him. And they gave then $25,000 to Texans for a Republican majority, which wasn't even Tom DeLay's federal PAC. It was a PAC that was designed to help pick up state legislator seats in Texas. Now, a Kansas energy company had no interest in that, but Tom DeLay was demanding the money, and so they got it. And Westar has actually been indicted in Texas by the attorney general down there for its role in the Trim PAC fundraising scandal. And yet, you know, nothing's happened to Tom DeLay.
Yeah, this is astounding. Well, to move along from Tom, I mean, you know, there's only so long we can hang out with him without starting to feel a little creepy. You were counsel to Joe Biden during Ruth Bader Ginsburg confirmation hearings.
Yes, that's right.
You were the attorney for counsel to Senator Joe Biden.
Right.
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, you know, the cons say, okay, you guys, when Clinton was president, you got a liberal in on the Supreme Court, therefore now it's our turn. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg, first of all, her name was recommended to Bill Clinton by Orrin Hatch of Utah. Was that not the case?
Oh, that may well be the case, but you know, I didn't know that story.
Yeah. Well, that's you know, I'm quite sure of that.
Okay.
And in fact, Clinton had reached out to Congress to the United States Senate and said to the Republicans in the United States Senate and said who would be acceptable to you. And Orrin Hatch gave Bill Clinton Ruth Bader Ginsburg's name, and that's where it came from. That's how it started. Now, what do you expect will be different? You were there during her confirmation hearings. What do you expect will be different, and what do you expect will be the same between her confirmation hearings and the ones coming up for Judge Roberts?
In some ways, I think they'll be very similar because Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg was known to be an eminently qualified person. You know, a lot of the time, some of these confirmation hearings get so contentious because a president is nominating somebody who they have reasons for nominating other than their legal qualifications.
Sort of like Bork.
Yeah, like Bork or, you know, mostly I think Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
Clarence Thomas, probably one of the least qualified people to ever reach the Supreme Court. And thus, you know, immediately a contentious nomination. Judge Roberts, like Judge Bader Ginsburg, is incredibly qualified. Probably one of the 100 lawyers in the country most qualified for that position, in fact. So he's going to get a lot of respect for that reason, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg did. You know, they both had solid records. A big difference, though, between Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Judge Roberts is that she had an extremely long written record. She had both written numerous opinions for her many years on the court, and she had written articles and given speeches. So she was much more of an open book. People knew what to expect from her. They knew a lot of her positions. Judge Roberts, on the other hand, has been on the Court of Appeals a relatively short time, only 2 years, hasn't written a lot of opinions, and hasn't written articles, and so we don't have the kind of background on him that we had on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which is what makes people, I think, rightfully nervous, because it is such a major thing to put somebody on the Supreme Court and he's basically a stealth candidate.
So how is the response of the Senate going to be different, or do you think that the Democratic senators are basically just going to roll over on this thing?
I think it depends what may come out. Interestingly, the administration has now released some of Judge Roberts' memos from his years when he was working for the White House. Interestingly, they're refusing to hand over the memos that he wrote while he worked in the Solicitor General's office, but they're handing over these other memos. I think we're going to see some very big controversy over why they've released some memos and not others. I think that'll be one fight. But another thing is that when reading these memos, some of them are really disturbing. Judge Roberts, Mr. Roberts, was often espousing a much more conservative opinion than even, say, Ted Olson, former Solicitor General, who's known for his conservative views, former head of the Civil Rights Division, William Bradford Reynolds, and Roberts was actually criticizing them as not taking the most conservative position. So if conservative groups have read these memos, that's why they're so thrilled about Judge Roberts, because the more you read his record, the more you read these memos, the more disturbing they are.
Do these memos reflect true conservatism, or do they reflect some sort of new extremism?
Well, some of them seem to be quite extreme, really. They seem to reflect some rather extreme conservative positions where he has...
For example,
he wrote, he has argued, even more strongly against affirmative action, for example, than the Civil Rights Division under the Reagan administration, which was, hardly an era when the affirmative action was in its heyday. Another really disturbing decision, I would say, is that there was a 1982 case where Roberts faulted the Justice Department for the outcome in a case called Plyer versus Doe. In that case, the Supreme Court overturned a Texas law that had allowed school districts to deny enrollment to illegal immigrant children. That's what Texas decided. They were going to try and stop illegal immigrant kids from going to school, which was basically just left lots of kids running around with nothing to do all day. And Roberts argued that, and the Solicitor General's office had stayed out of the case, and Roberts argued that if the Solicitor General's office had taken a position in the case supporting the state of Texas and, quote, the values of judicial restraint, it could have altered the outcome of the case, meaning that it would have, potentially the Supreme Court would have upheld Texas's decision not to allow kids to go to school.
Now, oddly, though, that's one that may have a lot of popular support in the United States.
It may, although I think when people think about that, the concept of having lots of children running around not in school as basically vagabonds will turn us into, one of those countries.
No, I understand the I understand the consequences of it. It's just that there's this incredible and growing anti-immigrant sentiment in the United States, and the cons are milking it for all it's worth, and a lot of progressives are actually becoming concerned about it as well. But that's a whole other discussion. Melanie Sloan, Cruise Executive Director, thanks for being with us, Melanie.
Thanks for having me.
Much appreciated.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Your wall's too high, I can't see. Can't see the reach you, can't set you free.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Judge Roberts says Moondog in our chat room. Actually, I'm looking at the article, editorandpublisher.com. An article about this. Judge Roberts may have had a hand in helping the elder Bush draft pardons for the Iran-Contra felons. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. I mean, this is where it gets really interesting. Because you will recall that Iran-Contra actually started It actually started in 1980, during the campaign of 1980. Jimmy Carter was president of the United States, and you had a number of the people who were in our embassy in Tehran, Iran, were taken hostage. There was a revolution essentially happened in Iran. The Shah was overthrown. The Shah of Iran was overthrown. Who we had installed into power. And in fact, we overthrew a democratically elected government to install the Shah, our guy, because his predecessor, I believe it was it Mossadegh? Correct me if I'm wrong. Scott thinks it is too. Anyhow, his predecessor had nationalized the oil. He had said, "Hey, the American oil companies, you can't just take our oil for free anymore. You're going to have to buy it from us." And we didn't like that, and so we overthrew him, and we put the Shah of Iran in there. Razi Pahlavi, or whatever his name was. And the Shah of Iran got cancer, and he wasn't doing all that well, and Jimmy Carter was trying to help him out, and they were going to fly into France, and he was getting cancer. And anyhow, there was this coup, and the mullahs took over, and the students took the American embassy. Now, this was the election year, and so the story goes, George Bush and Bill Casey, William Casey, who had once been with the OSS, which later became the CIA during World War II, Bill Casey, who then became director of the CIA when George Bush became president, but he was the campaign manager for George Herbert Walker Bush's campaign. Actually, it was Ronald Reagan's campaign, but Herbert Walker Bush was vice president, or running for vice president. But anyhow, George Bush and Bill Casey, so the story goes, went to Paris and met with representatives of the government of Iran and said, if you will keep those hostages until the elections in November, this was like in August or September, if you'll keep those hostages until the elections in November, it'll do so much political damage to Jimmy Carter that he'll lose. Reagan and Bush will become president. And we will then sell you these spare parts that you need to operate all these American missiles and other weapons that we sold the Shah, because they had all these weapons, but we wouldn't sell them any parts for it. We wouldn't sell them the missiles to go in their missile launchers because, they were now our enemies, right? And they said, okay, cool, we'll cut that deal with you. So Reagan wins the election. The hostages are held, devastates Carter in the polls. Carter was way ahead of Reagan early on, but in the last month or so, he just completely collapsed in the polls, largely because he was looking like a wimp because he couldn't free the hostages. The Iranians were holding on to them. The minute that Reagan puts his hand in the Bible for the swearing-in ceremony on January 5th, that moment, they release the hostages. To the minute. As if to say, we kept our end of the bargain, and within a month, we are secretly shipping missiles over to them. Illegally. Absolutely illegally. Sending the missiles. Now, there were no hostages being held anymore. Why are we selling the missiles? Well, the sort of memory that we have is that there was a hostage for missile swap or something. What was the deal? Well, this was treason. This was to hijack an election. Barbara Honegger, who worked in the White House, in the State Department, wrote a book about it called October Surprise. And there have been several other books about it. This is, widely and well documented. Well, as this was starting to come unraveled during the Iran-Contra investigations, there were six people who were going to be called before a special prosecutor, much like Patrick Fitzgerald and Karl Rove, to testify. If they had testified, it would have blown the lid off this thing, and it would have led to treason charges against George Herbert Walker Bush. They were pardoned by the Reagan-Bush administration in advance so that to stop cold the investigation, which is what I think George W. Bush is going to do with Karl Rove, by the way. They were pardoned, thus preventing any investigation into George Herbert Walker Bush's role in this, and it appears that one of the lawyers who helped engineer that was none other than John Roberts, now the nominee for the United States Supreme Court, who says the Bush administration doesn't take care of its friends.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I like to dream.
Yes, right to dream of some machine. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you'd like to drop into our live chat room for some of the most interesting, thoughtful, provocative, entertaining, insightful, and sometimes downright eccentric discussion on the entire internet. Just click live chat when you get there. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Bill in Lafayette, Indiana on the line. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just want to say that I think what you're saying about the cynicism involved with Iran is really at the root, I think, of our problem today. When I was in college, there were a lot of Iranian students who were protesting the brutality of the Shah and the Savak and everything.
Right.
And nobody paid a damn bit of attention. It was like, those people are crazy, you know,
and now it's come back to haunt us.
Right. Yeah. And not only that, like...
Well, it came back to haunt us actually in 1980.
Yeah, it did come back then, but I mean, just I think at the root we got to see the Arabs and all as people, like yeah. rather than George Bush being barbecuing the summer of September 11th while people were blowing themselves up in schoolyards and things like that.
Yeah, no, I got it, Bill, I got it, I absolutely good point, well made, thank you very much. 1-866-889-8894. Just a second, Bill Fletcher with the AFL-CIO is going to be with us. Jeff in Ohio on a truck. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, I work for the Democratic Party, and if Kerry would have been elected, he would have appointed judges that were a little bit to the left, would uphold Roe v. Wade. Guess what? He didn't win. And we don't need to be sore losers. Mr. Bush won, and he should put the judges he wants on the court.
Who?
What the hell is he going to do? Is he going to put a judge on there that's going to uphold Roe? No, he's not. Well, why is everybody acting all surprised there?
You think that the president is the only... Have you read the U.S. Constitution? The president isn't the only person who appoints judges to the Supreme Court. It's a cooperative venture between the president and the United States Senate. The House of Representatives is cut out of it. The rest of the judiciary is cut out of it. But the two of them have to work it out together, Jeff. I'd suggest you read the Constitution. It's a very straightforward document. Billy in Santa Cruz. Hey, Billy, what's up?
Hey, buddy. I'm listening to 540, and it's so exciting. Not only do I get to hear you in Santa Cruz, I'm in bed. I have to go down on my computer.
There you go.
So here's what I called about today, guy. First of all, to just pick up on what you were just talking about, yeah, that was another great example of how Republicans are not loyal to the country or to the Americans, but to their own party. This thing about keeping the hostages until he got elected.
Yeah.
Boy, if I was a hostage and that happened to me, don't ask me what I would do.
Yeah, 1980. Yeah, well, a number of the hostages were rather outspoken about it for a short while, and then they all got real silent. But that's a whole other thing, and it's kind of ancient history, which we can rehash some other time.
Here's current history.
Okay, yes, sir.
The court here, when you nominate a Catholic to the Supreme Court today, it's no good, and let me tell you why. I remember in the last election how a lot of Catholic priests did not allow the nominee to be able to take the wafer.
That's because Ratzinger sent a letter to the American Catholic bishops saying that that's how it should be. It was Ratzinger who sent that letter.
Well,
but at the same time, Billy, we got to note that the Constitution says the one thing that the Constitution says you can't use as a litmus test when you're appointing a judge is religion.
Yes, but as people who are thinking about who we're allowing on the court this time, we can't afford to allow someone who's going to operate under Sharia law.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, Billy. However, we can't say it's because he's Catholic. It has to be because of his decisions. Bill Fletcher is the former assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO. The AFL-CIO, of course, holding its convention this week. Yesterday, they made an historic announcement that they support the early withdrawal of troops from Iraq. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm curious, first of all, what your take is on that.
Oh, it's fabulous. It's the result of over 2 years of work that has been taking place at the local level of local unions and regional groupings coming together and feeling that the AFL-CIO has a moral obligation to take a position on this. And I think this is tremendous.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Oh, I have been hearing in the media, and this is making me absolutely crazy, Bill. Maybe you can help me out with this.
Mm-hmm.
Over and over and over again, some 30-odd times yesterday in different programs, pontificators, bloviators, and news reporters, or so they say, speculating about why the AFL-CIO, you know, why the Teamsters and SEIU and Unite, why this split is happening in labor. And consistently people are talking about, well, there's the decline of labor, there are fewer people being unionized, maybe it has to do with outsourcing, maybe, you know, that's about as close as they get to what's really going on. Nobody, not one person, except as far as I can tell on this program, has mentioned the fact that there's been a 50-year war against organized labor going all the way back to 1947 when over Harry Truman's veto, the Republicans took control of the House and Senate and pushed through the Taft-Hartley Act.
Right.
Yeah. And from that day until Ronald Reagan, it was kind of an underground war against organized labor, against the working people of the United States. Ronald Reagan made it into an overt war against working people in the United States. We now have a labor department that's supposed to be protecting labor that's openly hostile to the interests of labor. Why is none of this being discussed, not only in the press? I mean, I get that. It's the corporate press. Why is labor not talking about the war against labor?
You know, you're asking a $64,000 question. I mean, first of all, you hit it right on the nose. There has been a war against labor. And in some parts of this country, before Reagan, it was extremely vicious, like in the South and the Southwest. Part of what has infuriated me about what's going on within the union movement, it leads me to call this whole thing the great undebate, because the real issues that are facing the union movement have really not been put on the table. In fact, what we've ended up seeing is a very personalized attack against Sweeney, his very personalized response, a lot of structural proposals, but there's no big discussion coming out of either side about what is it that's confronting working people in this country and what do we do about it.
Right. And where is it coming from? I mean, that's the biggest thing that nobody, this is like the elephant
that's
in
right.
the room that nobody is discussing is, you know, okay, working people in this country are confronting, you know, more hours, lower pay, their pensions are being ripped off. Look at the United Airlines so-called bankruptcy. Even the federal government is not fully funding its pensions. It's borrowing that money to give tax cuts to billionaires. You know, corporations all across America underfunding their pensions. The Federal Pension Guarantee Corporation is looking like it might be facing bankruptcy. All these kinds of then nobody says why is this? It's this way because for 35 years overtly and for 50 or 60 years covertly, the Republican Party and some conservatives in the Democratic Party as well have been actively working to destroy the American middle class and replace it with a class of politically impotent people who are so desperate for their minimum wage jobs and working so hard that they will not get active in politics. What they saw back in the 30s and 40s, what happened when people organized and joined unions. They got politically active, and these guys don't want to have to face we the people.
No, you are absolutely right. When people are struggling...
Why isn't John Sweeney saying this?
Well, that's a good question. And I've actually raised that question to both sides. I think part of the answer, with all due respect to the leaders of these different unions and to the AFL-CIO, I think part of what's going on is that they really don't want to face the reality of the situation. This is not just true within the union movement. I've seen it in other movements.
This is like the battered wife syndrome.
It is.
Oh, if I'm nice, maybe
That's
he
right.
won't hit me again. You know, they're saying, oh, if we're nice to the Republicans, maybe they won't finally destroy us.
That's right. No, that's right. Or that if we hope or if we minimize the severity of the situation, at least we'll keep people's hope alive or something. It's absolutely absurd. What we need right now is an extremely aggressive union movement that is really advancing a social justice cause. We do not need to be sitting back on the defensive. And this so-called debate, when they counterpose organizing the politics, doesn't help because we need both. We just need to do it differently.
Yeah, and how is that going to come about?
It's going to have to come about through people at the base, man. I mean, it's just I think that.
So it's people like I'm a union member. Actually I'm a member of two different unions, the National Writers Union and AFTRA, and also the what do you call it? I'm forgetting the name. Anyhow, I'm a member of two unions and one labor organization, ILCA,
right.
The International Labor Communications Association.
Right. Oh, yeah,
in fact,
right.
I spoke at their
yeah.
convention on Saturday, and when I said, you know, this is all about a war against labor, that was the point. Everybody started applauding. Everybody
right.
gets it. Nobody's saying it. It takes an outsider
right.
like me to come in and say it. Anyhow, so what do people who are members of organized labor do?
They need to run for office. People that are members of unions, like you, need to run for office on a platform of, we're going to say what's actually happening to us, we're going to develop a strategy for that, and then we're going to figure out what kind of organizational vehicles we need. We're not going to tinker around the edges and come up with a very shiny, archaic machine. We're going to try to figure out what exactly we need to do.
But running for office is a little more of a long-term strategy. What can I do this week to get to let the people in AFTRA, for example, know that, hey, you know, you should be an activist union? This is the American Federation of TV and Radio Actors.
If you the most immediate thing that could be done, I mean, literally, if we're talking about this week, is that people that are union members should call or email their national headquarters and say, this so-called debate is a farce. And what we need is a real discussion about where we're going. And we don't need this playing around and tinkering around the edges. That's what we need. And this split is absolutely the worst possible time for such a thing to happen. I mean, I'd even go further. If they were splitting about something where there were clear differences, but when I was listening to and reading the different statements that were being made, these folks that are splitting, they were stumbling all over themselves. They couldn't explain what the big differences were.
Yeah. Well, but Bill Fletcher, former assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO, what you're describing, it just seems to me that there has to be, you're saying, okay, we need to be having a more activist, a more progressive conversation, these kinds of things. What it really sounds to me like you're calling for is a position statement. You know, how do you boil that down to a soundbite? How do you boil that down to a specific proposal, to a specific step that a specific, you know, that the AFL should be taking, or that this new federation or alliance that's going to come out of the SEIU and all these folks should be taking? If I just, you know, if I call up somebody at AFTRA and say, I just think this debate is a farce, they're going to say, okay, thank you very much. What do you do about that? I mean, you know, there's no clear, therefore do this.
There is actually a proposal that's gone before the AFL-CIO coming out of several unions that said, and they were hoping that this would be a compromise, but it was ignored, I guess, by the Change to Win people. But it needs to happen anyway. They basically said, we need to have a discussion. And that over the next year, about what working people in the United States are facing and what it is that needs to be done. And it laid out a whole series of questions, including, what is the role of a federation? What is the role of central labor councils? Things along those lines.
This is still all looking within. Why not put forward an initiative of sorts that says, we need to be identifying the enemy of organized labor. We
That's
need to identify the people who are trying to destroy the American middle class in order to maintain political power, because they don't want an empowered middle class in the United States. They don't want there to be, you know, they don't want the workers of America to have unions, because then they'll be politically active. And if they're politically active, then we can't continue to suck down all this money from these big multinational corporations and screw the working people of this country.
But that's not inconsistent with what I'm saying. That's the discussion.
But I think it needs to be said more overtly. I think it needs to be put in the terms, in the same kind of terms that the cons do it, of here's us, that's them, this is what they're doing to us.
Right, but you see, the difference between what you and I are saying, I think, is this. I'm saying that we've got to involve the members in this discussion, that part of
But you have to educate them first. I don't think most of the members realize that they are under siege.
That's right.
You've got a third of the members voting for George Bush.
I know, and that's why I'm saying that the kind of discussion needs to happen is a discussion at the base with the members about what is happening. A few years ago, when I was at the AFL-CIO, we had something called Common Sense Economics. It was an education program that was directed at members to talk about capitalism and class and understanding the situation. People loved it. I mean, people were just thirsting after it. Unfortunately, most of the union leaders did not think that it was that significant an effort to pursue. But that's the kind of discussion that needs to happen. Because the problem is, or I can make statements. In fact, I've written a lot of stuff about this current debate. It has to reach the person at the base. It has to reach the local union activist who gets fired up and says, I'm not taking this anymore. We need a union that stands for precisely what it was that you were saying.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bill, but I think it also needs to be taken into Rush Limbaugh terms, as it were, where we're saying to the people at the base, hey, these guys are out to destroy the way of life that you're working for.
That's right.
They really want to see in America, and they, with the very best of intentions, by
right.
the way, let's acknowledge that the Limbaughs of the world, the Hannitys of the world, the Jack Welches, the CEOs of the world, they actually believe that an aristocratic America, an America with a ruling elite that rules by virtue of wealth, is actually a more stable form of government, and that's a good thing for the United States. That's their belief structure. And let's just lay it out and say this is what these guys are working for.
That's right.
An America of, by, and for multimillionaires,
right.
and with no power to labor.
I agree.
And that discussion is not happening in
that's
America
right.
outside of a very small number of progressive talk shows.
And that's precisely my criticism.
And that's the discussion that labor needs to be having
that's exactly
up front
right. that's
and in the bluntest terms possible.
That's what should have been happening. And I would just want to say one thing. I don't assume good intentions on the part of our opponents, that is the rich. That what you see right now is this, it's almost like a rabid animal.
Well, it's a feeding frenzy. I mean,
right.
there's money to be made, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, certainly there's no shortage of greedy folks out there. But I think a lot of the ideologues actually believe their own propaganda.
Yeah, yeah.
They're wrong. History shows that they're wrong, but they believe their own propaganda.
That's
anyhow,
true.
Bill Fletcher, former assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO. Is there a website, Bill, people can learn more about you?
Yeah, for our organization, it's www.transafricaforum.org.
Great. Transafricaforum.org. Thanks, Bill.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. It's never too late
to start all over again. There you go. That's what we got to do. We got to restart the labor movement. Take power back to the people. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here, exposing the con in conservative. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Carolyn in Chicago, Illinois. Is that Carolyn K. of MakeThemAccountable.com?
It certainly is.
Great.
I have your soundbite.
Okay.
You said you needed, the labor needs a soundbite. How about this one? We want our share.
We want our share. Good one. Good one. Great. Carolyn, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's great. Thanks for listening. Armin in Sarasota, Florida, on the line. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind today?
I think about this all the time, just like you do, and I try to think of an angle that I haven't thought of before, or philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the establishment billionaires that don't feel that they're corrupted and tainted by corruption, that feel they're just, philosophically believe, this is what I feel they believe, the really supposed wise ones, I think that they think deep down inside that if this mass of middle class and working class were so capable of ruling their own destiny and controlling their wealth and for all practical purposes, the economy, the United States, they'd effectively be doing it now.
Yeah, and in fact, this is why John Adams referred to we the people as the rabble. You're spot on, Armin, and that's why they've got to keep us out of control, because they want to run the show. Carrie in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Carrie.
Hi, two stupid questions. I'm too young to know what happened to Jimmy Hoffa and why. Wasn't he ahead of a union, the Teamsters?
He was the head of the Teamsters, and Jimmy Hoffa, I think, and this is just my personal opinion because nobody knows what happened to him, but there is this old saying, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and just like the heads of corporations get corrupted by wealth and power, the heads of some unions in history have gotten corrupted by wealth
okay.
and power, and I think Jimmy Hoffa was one of them, frankly.
Also, in the 80s... I
should add, labor has done a lot to clean up its act since then.
Okay, so he was kind of corrupt in the view of other people. But in the 80s, I remember just being a child, and Ronald Reagan fired all those air traffic controllers.
Right, Patco.
Were they part of a union?
They were. It was the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association, yes.
So he fired all of them.
That's right. He did. He broke the union. He busted the union.
And so can that happen again?
Oh, sure. George Bush is doing it right now. They just did this with the Department of Homeland Security. I think it was 80,000 employees. They said, sorry, you're no longer a member of the union. Can't do it. And, union busting is a long tradition among the Republicans. Kerry, got to move along. Thank you for the call, though. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here in Portland, Oregon, broadcasting live coast-to-coast talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. You are right in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Speaking of think tanks, Robert Garmong is with us. He is a writer for the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. The Ayn Rand Institute and the objectivists there located, I think, are fairly important folks in American history, modern American history, because ever since Ayn Rand left the Soviet Union, came to the United States, wrote Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead and others, but in particular Atlas Shrugged, and came up with the idea of objectivism, initiated Alan Greenspan into that cult in her apartment in the 1950s in New York City. Her thinking has percolated through, in large part through the Cato Institute, but others, percolated through much of the modern conservative movement. And so here we are at the source, the fountainhead, to paraphrase. Robert Garmong, am I pronouncing it right, Robert?
Yes, that's right.
Great. Pleased to have you on the program. Did the space shuttle Discovery lifted off yesterday successfully, and it seems from the writing of yours that I'm reading here, you have a problem with that.
Well, I think the space shuttle is an amazing achievement. It's something to be admired greatly, and I don't want to take anything away from what NASA has done. However, my view is that space programs of the sort that the space shuttle represents ought to be fully and completely privatized as quickly as possible.
So that a few stockholders can make money on it.
So that I think that, as the whole history of capitalism has shown, everyone benefits. It's not just a few stockholders.
You mean like the Enron stockholders did?
The Enron stockholders obviously were the victims of tremendous fraud, and that's not indicative of the nature of capitalism. Look at the simple difference between how this country's economy works and how the Soviet Union's economy works. Or, if you like examples closer at home, look at the difference between UPS or Federal Express and the governmentally monopolized U.S. Postal Service. I think that the difference is tremendous, and the same types of energy, innovation, and will to succeed can be brought to the space program.
Well, hang on just a second here. You're trashing the post office. I can send a letter across the world for 30-some-odd cents. It's an institution that has lasted over 250 years. It's served this nation very well, continues to. What's wrong with that? UPS and FedEx can't do that.
UPS and Federal Express are not allowed to do that. By law, they're prevented from entering the market for standard rate postage. So they're simply not allowed to.
And their lobbying position is that they want to keep that law in place.
I don't know. I don't speak for either of them. I don't know what their...
Well, they're on the record. I mean, you find a lot of corporations. For example, Monsanto took the lead during the Reagan administration in arguing that they wanted regulations on genetically modified organisms. Why? Because those regulations would allow them to control the marketplace.
Okay, but we're a bit off of the...
Okay, let's get back to privatizing space exploration. You're saying that privatizing is a good thing. Privatizing, though, very often just leads to profiteering, does it not? I mean, in private companies, their primary goal is to maximize profit. Space, I mean, you know, there's important stuff to do. There's basic science, basic research that needs to be done in which there is no profit other than the fact that it benefits humanity. What corporation is going to do that?
Well, in my view, the kinds of basic research that you need in order to get into space are going to be done as part of the space program once it's privatized. And notice that we see what is done. We don't see what could be done. Consider how much NASA, of course, has created some great things. Teflon is just one example. However, what we don't see is all the innovations that would have been done had space exploration been private from the beginning.
But space exploration has been private from the beginning. You and I right now are being heard by people all over the United States because my voice here in Portland, Oregon, is being sent. You're in New York, are you not? I'm not sure where you are.
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Okay, you're in Austin, Texas. Your voice is bouncing off a private satellite back down to me. My voice is going from here in Portland to Denver, where it's being put up on the ABC Starguide satellite up above the Earth, private satellite launched as a private venture. That satellite drives it down to radio stations all over the United States. In New York, Sirius Satellite is picking that thing up. They're beaming it up to their three private satellites in outer space that are beaming it down to Sirius listeners all over the United States and Canada. Space has been privatized for a long, long time. Where is all, you know, what private corporation decided to discover when the universe began and put a Hubble Space Telescope up? I don't, you know, none of them have done it.
Well, I think your example is a very good one, and it demonstrates precisely the fact that all those greedy profiteering companies do produce tremendous value to us. And I think
I'm all in favor of free enterprise.
Right.
I'm just saying that there are some things. I have two big concerns. Number one, there are some things that we as a society, we collectively through our social contract and compact, that we decide that are sufficiently important for us that even if there's no money in it to be made by a small number of stockholders, we still want it done. We'd like to know how old the universe is. We'd like to know what life is like on other planets. And if wonderful things come out of that, a cure for cancer or whatever, you know, in Teflon, that's marvelous. But if nothing comes out of it, basic science is its own reward. We're willing to pay for that, and even if there's no profit to be made for a corporation, number one. And number two, I'm concerned about the fact that very often when corporate behavior is not tightly constrained, it becomes toxic. You look at the entire communities that have been wiped out by chemical plants, for example. You know, the Love Canal thing, all the toxic waste around the United States. Think of if space was completely privatized and completely unregulated, which I'm assuming, you know, you just want regulations against fraud, completely unregulated, and a bunch of people started putting up satellites that, for example, were powered by plutonium. And after a while, they start falling back down into the Earth. 1 ounce of plutonium properly distributed around the planet would give lung cancer to every single living human being.
Well, you're raising very disparate issues here. Let me take them one at a time. The idea of basic research, I think, is something that is certainly a noble goal, and if a university, for instance, wants to engage in that there's nothing wrong with that. I think that it could be handled far more efficiently.
What university could fund the space shuttle, Robert?
There are consortiums of private universities, public universities, companies that care about basic research because true benefits do fall out of basic research. There's
well, then if we're talking about public universities, we're back to government again. Why, you know, why add another layer in there? Why not just do it through NASA?
Well, and that too, I believe, ultimately should be privatized. But my point is that it shouldn't be your right to decide that I have to fund basic research when I may not wish to, and I may prefer to have my money go elsewhere. Private organizations don't have the power to coerce anyone to support them, and I think that makes them morally far superior to any kind of basic research done by government. And I think that furthermore, on a purely economic level, even if we do want to have public funding for for basic research, which, as I say, I would ultimately oppose, fine, have it, but I think it would be handled far more efficiently by a private market.
So, Robert Garmong, you're suggesting that there is no social contract between us, that we as members of a society really shouldn't have the power to collectively say, okay, the majority of us. Robert doesn't agree, but the rest of us agree that we'd like to know what's in the Crab Nebula, and we're all willing to contribute a buck of our paycheck every year to the space program. Robert doesn't want to, but we're going to collectively get together and say, Robert, you got to do it anyway because you're part of society. You get other benefits from society. You may not consider this one of the benefits, but, you know, collectively we're society. You just believe that that whole social contract thing is a bunch of nonsense?
Well, I happen to be a political philosopher, and historically the idea of a social contract has been very, very vague and misused, so I'll steer away from that terminology. I do not believe that if three people are stranded on a desert island, two of them have the right to vote, to cook and eat the third. I don't believe you have that right. I don't believe that you have the right to initiate.
I'm not suggesting that.
Anyone, even if society gets together and votes on it. I'm not an advocate of democracy, as our founding fathers were not advocates of democracy. I believe every individual has the right to life, liberty, and property. And
excuse me, the founding fathers created this democratic republic. How can you say they were not advocates of democracy?
Founding fathers were very clear that they did not want a democracy, that what they wanted was a republic, and that the difference is that in a republic, the government is absolutely and strictly confined and constrained, in our case by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, so that the initial idea, which we've strayed from considerably in this country, was that the government should exist strictly to protect your rights.
Yeah, you're quoting James Madison from Federalist 54. I suggest you read Robert Dahl's book, How Democratic is the American Constitution. Madison was, you know, prior to 1787, the word democracy and the word republic in the dictionary meant the exact same thing. Madison split the two in as part of his sales job on the Constitution, saying democracy is mob rule, we don't want that. A republic respects the rights of minorities, and we're going to have that. Later on in his life, Madison was back to calling this a democracy. James Madison himself. I mean, you know, I think you're splitting hairs, Robert, but you know, you never addressed my question. Well, actually, we've got a couple of guests a couple of callers who have questions for you as well, but in the minute before we take a break, and then we'll come back and take a few calls if you're willing to stick around for it. I'm just wondering, how would you restrain private corporations from doing things in outer space that might ultimately be destructive to us?
Well, I think that that is a good question, and part of the problem with governmental space exploration is that we don't have a legal structure to protect rights in space and to protect people from this kind of scenario that you projected.
Yes, we do. It's called the ballot. If our elected representatives, they represent us, if they're making stupid decisions, we vote them out of office.
That's right, but there is no system of property rights in space, and that, I think, has significantly hampered and constrained private exploration.
So you think that space should be carved up and it should be up for sale for the highest bidder?
I think it should be exactly like property here on Earth, I believe.
But isn't it part of the commons? Do you think that all of the air in the United States should be carved up? Do you think all the water should be privately owned?
I do believe that there are currently property rights systems over those things, and there ought to be, and those things ought to be defined more.
Okay. We're talking with Robert Garmong. He's with the Ayn Rand Foundation, Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, and we'll take your calls and Robert's comments right after this break. Should space be privatized? Should we do away with NASA? Is it a terrible waste of money? Should we do away with taxes? 20 minutes past the hour.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, a call to take back America by Tom Hartman, available in bookstores everywhere.
We'll be right back.
is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You may be an ambassador to England or France.
Yeah, welcome back. But you're going to have to serve somebody. Yeah, we know that, Bob. Hey, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. We're talking with Robert Garmong, who is with the Ayn Rand Institute, A-Y-N-R-A-N-D. Center of Objectivist Thinking in the Universe. Welcome back, Robert. All right, Robert, let's take a few phone calls. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky on the line. He has a question for you. Dennis, you're live with Robert.
Yes, sir. Real quick, I've got a big major problem with this whole thing that he's putting forth here, this whole idea of privatizing space. The biggest thing is the technology that was used to get us there in the first place was paid for by the American government, which was paid for by the American citizen. And corporations have a history of dispersing technology wherever they see. Like currently, a lot of companies are taking the semiconductor business over to China, and they're now going to be able to surpass us very soon in that technology and a lot of other technological areas. So, you know, my thing is, are you loyal to the United States or are you not loyal to the United States, who made all these things possible through the taxpayers' blood, sweat, money?
Robert?
Well, you are raising an important issue, and I do think that technology certainly should not be, military technology in particular, should not be shared with our enemies like China, which is a sworn
But it's enemy not being done that currently right now. We're currently, this free trade Pharisee ideas that you have is currently being, it's dispersing American technology
right.
all over the world.
For-profit corporations are putting profit ahead of nationalism in the positive sense, Sir Robert.
It is absolutely true that companies need to be prevented from selling particularly technology with military applications to sworn
enemies. They're not doing it now. Nobody's checking them now. You know, like I said, the semiconductor business is going to China and India.
We can't build a missile without parts from China right now.
You may have noticed that I am not a defender of the status quo in that respect or in any other. So I think that it absolutely is the responsibility of our government to prevent that sort of thing from happening.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you very much, Robert. Let's move along. Tom in Minneapolis on the line. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Robert. I've got a question for you. Do you guys or do you believe that Sweden, France, and Germany are socialist countries?
Depends on your definition of socialist, but
well, how do you define it?
They certainly have significant elements of socialism in them.
Right.
My view is that I think that any country, to the extent that it has governmental control of the economy, is acting on the premise of socialism. Where exactly you define?
Let's define some terms here. European countries are freely elected democracies. They have regulated capitalism as their economic system. They have millions of private businesses. You guys think rules and laws make a democracy all of a sudden autocratic, communist, socialist. You guys mix the political with the economic, and you fail to realize that a free people and a democracy are superior to a capitalist system. The people, we the people, elect and have authority over the way we organize our economic affairs, and you guys will not acknowledge that. You do not believe in democracy, is that right?
That's right.
That's right. Well,
not democracy. It's defined as the absolute power of the people to invade and violate other people's rights.
So you don't believe that we the people have the right to organize our affairs?
Collectively.
Yeah. I do not believe that we, the people, have the right to violate other people's rights.
And a violation of other people's rights, for example, Robert, would be telling the company that they can't produce certain toxins or that they have to adhere to the precautionary principle or that space is going to be regulated.
Well, you're mixing in a whole lot of different issues here.
Right.
I do not believe...
We only have about 10 seconds left. I'm sorry, by the way.
Okay.
Don't have the right to violate rights, and anything that protects my rights is a perfectly valid function of the government. But the valid function of the government is not to take up the criminals' policies and begin invading my rights.
Okay, Robert Garmong with the Ayn Rand Foundation, or Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRND.org. Robert, thank you for being with us.
rigorously exploring the truth of the day. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, Jackson Brown got it right. 27 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. By the way, speaking of the power of private corporations and coercion, this from the Globe and Mail, the newspaper in Toronto, Canada, by Simon Avery. The headline, are you ready? Bill Gates will be frisking you with a simple point and click. The next time you visit the website of Microsoft Corp to download some software, be prepared to let the world's biggest software company have a look inside your computer. Beginning today, Microsoft will require that all customers coming to its website for upgrades and other downloads submit their computers to an electronic frisking. Pam Dixon, Executive Director of World Privacy Forum, says it sets an extremely negative precedent. Microsoft is saying, before I let you do anything at all, you have to open your computer to us. I really object to this, says Pam. The company will scan your machine for a variety of information, including product keys, software authorization codes, operating system versions and details on the flow of data between your operating system and other hardware, such as printers. Says Pam, they are grabbing more information than they need to deter piracy. If Microsoft deems a PC to be carrying contraband code, it won't allow a user to download Microsoft programs with the exception of security patches. But the company, the software company, which says that more than one in five U.S. computers runs a counterfeit version of its Windows product, is not just waving a stick, it's also offering a carrot. They'll give you an upgrade. the article goes on and on, but... This big bugaboo for Bill Gates for a long time, which, by the way, raises the issue that has been raised before on this program of, could it be that people who are incredibly, mind-bogglingly, fabulously wealthy, way beyond anything that they could ever spend or their families, even for seven generations, could ever spend, that way because they are suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder. And the object of their obsession, rather than hand washing or chain smoking or whatever, the object of their compulsion is the accumulation of money, the Scrooge McDuck syndrome. Could it be? Anyhow, and if so, do they get obsessed about other things like, people are trying to steal my software, therefore I must control the world. Obsessive compulsive disorder could be. I don't know. I can't diagnose Bill Gates. I don't know him. But it's interesting speculation. Welcome back to our program. 36 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Kent in Chicago, Illinois, on the line. Hey, Kent. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I hope Robert is still listening because I have some figures for him that he can relate to from a purely financial perspective.
Okay.
It is estimated that illegal drugs cost the American economy $80 billion a year in lost productivity. I worked for a public university for 3 years, College of Pharmacy. Our largest grant winner was a professor who did mostly work for NHS, okay, paid for by the taxpayers. However, the work she did had no commercial value because a lot of the work she was doing was looking at the synaptic connections and the connections in the brain that is affected by opiates and how to go about getting precursor drugs that would disconnect one from that addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is in the interest of society.
Sure.
But, you know, it has no commercial value.
Well, there's a commercial value to helping people not be addicted to things. By the way, I can't speak for Robert, but I can tell you that generally the official line of the objectivists and the libertarians is that they are opposed to the criminalization of any drugs.
And so what would be would we just have, you know, lost productivity in society and have societal problems that goes with it?
Yes. Frankly, I mean, you look back at the United States in the 100 years ago, and no drugs were illegal. You could buy cocaine; it was called Coca-Cola, right? And you could buy opium; it was Lydia Pinkham's tonic. Ladies took it, you know. It was opium, or you had paregoric, you know, for diarrhea. In fact, that was sold right up and through the 1950s. And so, you know, all of these substances were just unregulated, and of course, pot as well.
You wouldn't need to regulate it because, okay, if you're selling this, then obviously the government would be involved in collecting revenue of some sort from this. I mean, you know, there would be sources of providing the raw materials, so it would still be regulated somewhere.
Yeah, well, see, that's, my position on this is that I think that, first of all, clearly there are some drugs that are not drugs. They're toxins.
Yeah, exactly.
And they need to be dealt with as if they are poisons.
Exactly.
For example, heroin and cocaine. There are some drugs, on the other hand, that I think, fall into the category of recreational drugs like alcohol. And frankly, I think tobacco should be criminalized. Alcohol, tobacco kills people when used as directed. Alcohol at least doesn't kill people when used as directed, and neither does pot.
I think Robert needs to consider something that you say often. You know, without government, you cannot have commerce because the government provides the currency, which is the form of bartering.
Right.
Who would have done that?
And the court system to enforce the contracts.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, anyway, thanks, Tom. You have a great day.
You're welcome, Kent. Thanks a lot for the call. You open a whole lot of different topics there, and a lot of roads that we could go down. We're not going to right now, but it's a good start. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida, on the line. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Well, I guess I have to correct you. There, according to an article, one of two articles here in Florida, pot can kill you.
Okay. How so?
Well, I'll tell you how. Jacksonville. This was last week. Mother of a jail inmate wants to know how her son suffered injuries during a fight with guards in February, left him in a persistent vegetative state. He was there for possession of marijuana. So he's basically dead, brain dead. That's in Florida.
Oh, he was killed by the pot laws, in other words.
Yeah, this is a pro-life state. We have a pro-life governor. Okay?
Wait a minute.
About a year
ago. About Florida. Isn't your governor in favor of the death penalty?
Oh, yeah, but that's because he's pro-life.
Isn't your governor in favor of the war in Iraq?
Well, that's because he's pro-life.
Isn't your governor opposed to stem cell research that could save lives?
Well, that's because he's religious.
I see. Okay.
Okay, and the other issue, about a year ago, another woman in jail for possession of marijuana, she was pregnant, she was screaming that she was going into labor. They ignored her. She gave birth at the foot of her toilet in the cell.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, she got attention. The baby was born dead. So it looks like pot does kill, doesn't it?
Yeah, well,
especially in pro-life Florida.
Yeah, there you go, Phil. The irony is unmistakable. No comment necessary. Thank you for sharing those stories with us. I appreciate the call. Let's just when corporations privatize the commons. There's a very clean line of division here, and this is the thing that needs to be it needs to be taught in our schools. It needs to be clearly understood. It's not, unfortunately, part of our public discourse. This is something that everybody in America in the 1700s, in the 1800s, and in the first half of the 1900s, the first half of the 20th century, everybody understood. And there's a generation growing up now who don't understand this concept, and that's the concept of the commons. People say, well, why did they call it the Commonwealth of Virginia or the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? There must be some kind of archaic word. No, it's because when those states were put together, those commonwealths were put together, there was this belief that there is some wealth that we hold in common. That wealth includes the streams, the waters, the forests, the air, the natural beauty, the ability to produce food that is safe. And we've added now, there's the natural commonwealth, and in many countries, in fact, probably in most countries of the world, the mineral resources that are found under the earth are considered to be the property of society. So when oil is pumped out of the ground, the profit from it doesn't go into the pockets of one guy who happened to find it in that one particular spot, even though the oil well may be tapping into a pool that's 100 miles in diameter. It doesn't go into his pocket or his company's pocket. Instead, it goes into the pocket of the state. And then the state uses that money. And this is how it's done in Mexico. It's how it's done in Venezuela. It's how it's done in many countries in the world. And ironically, every time a state starts privatizing their oil, like Iran did, we overthrow their government. Like Iraq did, we overthrew their government when they privatized their oil. You know, our oil companies don't like that. But in any case, there is this idea of the commons, the commonwealth. And while I don't think any of us would want the government making our shoes or the government making our computers, on the other hand, there are these things that we do share in common, that we hold in common, and that are so vital, that are so important, that it's important that the commons be administered by an agency that, number one, is completely and exclusively answerable to we the people, and not answerable instead to some other motive, like profit, or a small group within we the people, like a board of directors or stockholders. In other words, it's answerable to everybody. That's called government. Good government. And so, number one, the commons, you know, in the hands of, and number two, this overarching thing of the commons is not only answerable to us, but is held in trust by us. It is, you know, completely our property, our entirely our property, all the time. And this is just, you know, such a, you know, fundamental and basic concept. I just, you know, and we don't want private corporations, like I said, we don't want private corporations telling us that they're going to control our, well, unfortunately, they do in many cases, our water supply, for example, or our air. I mean, look at what happened down in Bolivia when Bechtel went in and said, okay, from now on, if you want to collect rainwater, you have to buy a permit from Bechtel Corporation or from the corporation that Bechtel was an investor in. You want to collect rainwater. Didn't go over real well with the people. I mean, it basically produced a revolt. It's just an absolute revolt. But the cons look at this and they say, you know, that thing of the commons, we don't really believe in the commons. Or if the commons is there, we want to try and get it in our hands as quickly as possible so that the broad mass of the people, they don't have access to it anymore. You know, this whole idea of good government, we don't believe in that. Paul Weyrich is one of the leading conservative theoreticians, one of the guys who founded the direct mail industry for Ronald Reagan, claims himself, he wrote a book about the new media, claims himself that he was responsible in large part for the election of Ronald Reagan. Paul Weyrich on the whole concept of government.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
You get that? Our leverage goes up as the voting populace goes down? And our last guest saying, no, I don't believe in democracy? Are you starting to get where Limbaugh and Hannity and all these guys are coming from? What happens when things are privatized? You get profiteering. You get corruption. There's no accountability to the public. You get cuts in essential services because they want to try and privatize monopolies. You get inefficiency. Yes, inefficiency. Centralized enterprise is almost always more cost-effective than multiple smaller ones. Therefore, splitting up a public company into smaller chunks actually reduces, smaller private chunks, reduces the efficiency. You get natural monopolies, which are not necessarily healthy if they're in the hands of private companies. You get a concentration of wealth. You get insecurity, national insecurity. I mean, look at what's happening. We can't, as I said, we can't build a missile now without parts from China. China, who a few weeks ago threatened our 100 cities in America with nuclear weapons. You get downsizing. You get the waste of risk capital. And frankly, the reality is that not all good things are profitable. Harriet in Washington State on the line in Seattle, aren't you, in Harriet?
Yeah.
Hey, Harriet, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to, if I can go back to something you said about these security updates with Microsoft.
Yeah, this is, talk about a natural monopoly. I mean, this is capitalism run amok.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've got to tell you a couple of things about that. Well, first of all, the checking your machine only applies, as I understand it from the security stuff I read, only applies to the security updates. So
What I read was that they will still give you security upgrades for free, even if they find pirated software, but they will not give you upgrades to their programs if they find any other pirated software on your computer.
Well, I think what they're going to do is give you the option to buy their software at a reduced rate, which is absolutely absurd. But
well, it's more profitable.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm not an advocate of piracy, by the way. Let me just be on the record for that.
Me either.
So,
but it's the sort of thing if they fail to, and I think they finally came to the realization, if they fail to allow the security updates, then anybody can run the exploits and create denial of service attacks back on whomever. And it's just, you know, they, I think, could be liable for that at some point down the road.
Interesting. My concern with Microsoft, frankly, has not so much to do with this. This is the thing that's going to get a lot of publicity. My concern with Microsoft is the same that the European Union has, which is that they have behaved in a monopolistic way for many, many, many years.
Yes.
I have known a couple of people who started businesses around products that were really cool little PC products, and then Microsoft said, oh, that's cool. You know, everybody's going to want that. Let's just make a free version of it and incorporate it into Microsoft Windows. And boom, these companies are out of business. That's anti-competitive. That's monopolistic. And I think that, you know, and the European Union thinks it's illegal and should be illegal. Harriet, thanks for the call and for the comment. We're up against a time, up against a break here, not a time, but I appreciate your call. And it's not just Microsoft, by the way. And let's keep in mind, Microsoft is acting within the law, as the law is currently being interpreted. The Sherman Act, essentially, which would have prevented this, essentially hasn't been enforced since Ronald Reagan came into office. And frankly, in my opinion, if we want to have real free enterprise in the marketplace, if you want to see real competition, we need to be breaking up some of these huge monopolies and go back to enforcing the Sherman Act. 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
What a friend we have in W.
Ah, yes, good old W.
Upright, strong, and resolute.
Oh, he's so resolute.
God wished him to be our leader.
Yep, it was God's idea.
The court could not but follow.
And that's why Sandra Day O'Connor had to vote for him, you know?
How many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome?
Oh, there's Paul Weyrich again.
They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Choice arrives.
Yes, well, if I run that too long, somebody's just going to casually tune in to perhaps our newest affiliate, KRXA 540 in Monterey, California, and go, what? They've changed their format to what? and hop off someplace. So we'll come back. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 4 minutes before the hour. Hal listening on KRXA in Monterey, AM 540 on the line. Hey, Hal, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Tom, you know what? I was wondering, is it, it was confirmed, right, that Bill Gates did, and Microsoft did donate to the W re-election campaign and the election in 2000?
I frankly don't remember, Hal. I'm sorry.
The reason I think that I'm pretty confident that happened is because right after he took office, he had the Justice Department drop the lawsuit that they had won against Microsoft.
I know that there's a lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. that has the name Gates in it. It's like Jennings Gates or Bryant Gates or something like that. And it's one of the largest and newest lobbying firms in Washington, D.C. That's funded by Microsoft.
Well, I think all the religious righties out there should understand that Microsoft, of course, has, you know, pretty much been, in terms of social issues, at the forefront of liberal policy. But when it comes to money, they're going to put it where they can make the most
at the expense
of their customers.
Yeah, they've been at the forefront of liberal policy, sort of. I mean, it turned out that Microsoft had Ralph Reed on its salary to the tune of $300,000 a month, more or less, for some time, and they pulled their support of gay, you know, supporting the gay employees, and then they came back. This is in the state of Oregon here. They're in the next state over. They got involved and ultimately endorsed a measure, it's called Senate Bill 1000, that would have given civil unions and protected gay rights here in the state, but only after considerable anguish. And as I said, they had Ralph Reed on their advisory panel for quite some time. So it's a mixed bag with Microsoft. Thanks a lot for the call, though, Hal. Good to hear from you. We've got to wrap up the hour here. Thanks for being with us so far. One more hour to go. Speaking from behind the good old stainless steel microphone, I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 5, 6, 7 minutes. 7 minutes, yeah. One more second. There we go. 7 minutes after the hour. Welcome back to our program for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Glad to have you with us. Toll free across the United States, our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. Dr. Jack Cassell is the author of Better Living Through Urology. You can get a copy of his information about his book from BLTUrology.com, just as an FYI. He's also the owner and operator of Demented Dreck, a theatrical prop rental house that holds over 1,000 unique and bizarre accent pieces. But right now, he's on the road talking about let's privatize entirely our healthcare system. Do I have that right, Dr. Cassell?
Yes, sir. You sure do, Tom. I mean, I think this is getting to be the motor vehicles department, little by little.
Okay, so let me get this straight. When I was growing up, 40, 50 years ago here in the United States, counties, if a hospital was going to be operated in a county or in a community, in a town, it had to be either a nonprofit corporation or owned on a nonprofit basis by the local community, because its first job was to get people well. And then, of course, came Reagan and the wave of privatization, and Bill Frist's family got in on the act and started buying up these county hospitals, mostly county hospitals, and privatizing them. And now Bill Frist's father is one of the richest men in America, according to Fortune magazine, a multi-billionaire. Their family corporation has paid over $800 million in fines for criminal activity. Now, if you or I engaged in criminal activity, we'd be in jail. Bill Frist, instead, is in the Senate. And you think that's a good thing?
Well, I'm not really. That's, I think, a little different echelon of the issue here.
Well, that's what happens when you privatize healthcare, isn't it?
Well, I'm talking basically in terms of the physician arm. You know, basically, what they're doing is they're nationalizing healthcare, which is okay if everything gets nationalized. I mean, the drug companies are still in the free market; they can charge whatever they want. The insurance companies are still in the free market, and they can raise their rates as doctors' reimbursement rates are going down. So as far as the hospitals are concerned, I mean, I think that's an issue I truthfully have not explored in terms of their fiscal status.
Yeah,
know?
Well, you know, what I told you is just straight up. I mean, it's not a secret.
And I
are paying for it. You know, you as a physician and me as a patient, we're all paying for it so that Bill Frist can become a billionaire. And that's the result of privatization of health care in the United States.
Well, in terms of the hospital, if it happens with the hospitals, but I'm just saying that.
So you're not in favor of hospitalization, of hospitals being privatized?
Well, that's an issue that I really haven't even dealt with. I'm looking at the doctor-patient relationship from my end. I'm kind of like working it on from my little world here, and I can just tell you that basically everything is going down the crapper.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with you there, Dr. Cassell. Because we have this very bizarre system in the United States that's mostly private and partially public.
Right.
And we now, as 4% of the world's population, last year spent $1 trillion on health care. That's 40% of all the money spent on health care on the entire planet. 40% of all the health care expenditures in the entire planet for 4% of the world's population. And yet, according to the World Health Organization, we're 15th in the world in terms of health standards, whereas Canada, who spends only 9% of their GDP on health, we spend 19% of our gross domestic product on health. Canada is ranked number 2 in the world.
And why do you think that is?
Well, it's because they have essentially a single-payer healthcare system. You know, they have a system where you don't have health insurance companies in the middle. Right now, for every $100 that goes through Medicare, the national, you know, Medicare is a single-payer healthcare system. I mean, we have in the United States, we have a socialized program. It's called the Veterans Administration. And we have a single-payer system, which is very different from socialized medicine. It's called Medicare. And right now, for every $100 that goes through Medicare, about $2 sticks to the fingers of the administrators of Medicare to figure out who should be paid and how they should be paid and reimbursements and all that kind of stuff. So the overhead is 2%. And because we agree that this is part of the commons of our health care, we collectively say, okay, we'll pay that 2%. If for every $100 that goes through private health insurance companies and HMOs in the United States, between $15 and $38, depending on what state you're looking at, sticks to the fingers of those private corporations. Now, they will tell you, and they're truthful in saying this, that they can do it for less than the 2% that Medicare can do it for. They do it by outsourcing it to India. They got people in India, you know, going through the records. They squeeze people's salaries. So where is the extra 15, 20, 30% going? It's going, you know, they've got to pay dividends to their stockholders. They got to pay multimillion-dollar salaries to their CEOs.
Absolutely.
They've got to have their multimillion-dollar headquarters. They got to have the gold-plated bathrooms in their private corporate jets so that their executives don't have to fly on, you know, regular airplanes with the rest of us. And how does that serve us?
Well, I'm with you. You know, I mean, I totally agree with that. I mean, HMOs call the amount of money that goes to providing health care the medical loss ratio. You know, I mean, I'm not saying – I think insurance companies and HMOs basically are the parasite. You know, I mean, health care is a doctor taking care of a patient, maybe using a hospital, but – The way things are going with everyone, you know, kind of like parasitizing the healthcare dollar, there's really no hope in sight as far as I can see.
So, Dr. Jack Cassell, it sounds to me like although you know you were presented to us as a conservative who believes that we should entirely privatize our healthcare system, it sounds like really you're an advocate of single payer healthcare.
Well, I like when they talk about competitive managed care. I mean, I kind of see the insurance companies competing against each other, not physicians. That's not.
But that's what we have right now. We have insurance companies competing against each other, and we're all getting screwed.
Well, there's not.
Why not take the insurance companies out of the equation? You know, I lived in Germany for a year. There are no insurance companies in Germany because you can walk into any doctor's office and get any kind of service immediately, and that doctor will get paid immediately. And the cost of administration,
right.
2.1%.
That's fantastic. And the standard of care is
higher than the United States.
Yeah. Well, I don't doubt it. I mean, let me tell you from my standpoint, from a doctor's standpoint, we get punished for doing an efficient job. You know, it's like somebody comes into my office. I have a sharp clinical acumen. I can talk to them for 3 minutes, ask them the right questions, a little hands-on. 5 minutes later, have an accurate diagnosis. I have to charge the cheapest visit possible. Now, if I kind of play it and I order a test that I get $500 for, and I send them to and I spend more time with them, and I make a hell of a lot more money. It's basically, you know, it's not a good system. Right.
Yeah.
We're not
it doesn't
being,
serve you. It doesn't serve the patients. However, it does serve the insurance companies.
Right. Yeah.
And that's, you know, we have a system right now that is profit driven rather than health driven. And now they're looking at the difference between a single payer health care system like Medicare or like Germany has and a socialized healthcare system like England has or like the Veterans Administration, what you see is that where the government actually gets in the business of owning the hospitals, the Veterans Administration actually owns its hospitals, whereas Medicare doesn't own any hospitals. And England actually owns their hospitals. When the government gets into the business of owning hospitals, it starts getting messy. Particularly when it's a big central organization. Now, you can argue that when local counties owned hospitals, they were accountable to the very people that they were serving, and the standard of care was quite high in the United States from the 1930s through the 1970s. But when you have centralized ownership of the hospitals like they do in England, they got a very messy system. I don't think, frankly, anybody that I know of in the United States, any progressives or liberals or middle of the road or anybody, is advocating socialized medicine in the United States. We're seeing that it's a messy thing. But a single-payer healthcare system where we simply say, okay, there are no more insurance companies. We
right.
don't need them. Let them free those people to go do something productive, right?
Right.
And
but it ain't happening, Tom. It's not going to. I mean,
over 80% of Americans want it.
Well, I mean, they'll be sold a bill of goods. I mean, if somebody wants to sell America socialized medicine, it's going to happen, but the trial lawyers don't want it because then the deep pocket is gone, basically. That would be the government, and the government's not going to get sued. Insurance companies have a big enough lobby that they're certainly not going to be made inactive. But let me get back to one thing you did say. You said Canada had like a fairly good standard of care. Well, you know, they also get their drugs from us. You know, I mean, some old lady's eating cat food in the Bronx because her drugs cost so much, and the drug company's basically just like flipping them over to Canada for just over wholesale.
You know why that is?
Well, they want to move them.
Yeah, it's because. The drug companies are for-profit corporations who are
right.
in business, and if they can make a penny a pill in Canada,
right.
that's a penny a pill. And if you sell a million pills, you sell a million pills. In Canada, because they have a single-payer system, they have centralized purchasing. And they go to Merck and they say, okay, we want 50 million tablets of penicillin this year. Inserted a rider into it that said it's a crime. It's an actual crime. You can go to jail if you're an administrator in the federal government for trying to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies. All drugs have to be sold at full retail. So Merck is selling that same penicillin in the United States and making a $2 profit per pill on it,
right.
but they're making one penny in Canada. They can get by making one penny a pill. That's why they continue to sell them to Canada.
Yeah, how do they do it? Volume.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But we have, again, our system has been corrupted here in the United States by the profit motive. You have these corrupt pharmaceutical companies buying off corrupt politicians like Bill Frist, and, you know, here we are with a mess.
Okay, you're right. I mean, I'm totally with you, and I think that you agree with me in at least in part about the problem that you know doctors are having. I mean, we're really getting squeezed, and you know, I mean, if we only saw an endpoint, urology in general, across the board, 4% cuts in our federally funded reimbursement for the last 10 years, except for this year. Now it was 13%. You know, we are not told where the endpoint is. We don't know. I mean, where does it stop? I mean, do you want people to go into medicine? I mean, there has to be a profit involved. If you're going to have a lifestyle
there has to be good pay. I mean, I can tell
yeah.
you, the doctors, I knew a good friend of mine is a physician in Germany, and still is, and he's paid a salary. And his salary in U.S. dollars would be probably the equivalent of around $170,000 a year. And he's paid that salary whether he sees 30 people or whether he sees 300. And so he provides a good quality standard of care, and he went into medicine not because he wanted to get rich, because he's never going to make more than $200,000
right.
a year, but he went into medicine because he wants to serve people through medicine.
Right.
That was his passion.
Exactly.
And I'm telling you, having used that service, and my wife and I and our three kids lived there for a year, and all five of us used their health care service system, it really works.
It would. I'm not sure if they would have, like, if they would, it would be like an HMO is around here in which.
No, not at all. There's no central control. All the control is done at the level of the doctor.
Okay, so if a patient wants to come into the office, he doesn't necessarily have to.
There is no approval process. You walk into the doctor's office and say, I'm here, and it's up to the doctor. I got to run. Doctor, thank you. Dr. Jack Cassell, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, what's
what's wrong with this picture, George W. Bush in the White House. I'll tell you, there's something wrong with that picture. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour. Ellen Ratner, our Washington Bureau Chief for the Tom Hartman Radio Program from Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi, Tom. You're not going to believe this, but the president went up to the Hill today to talk about why they should pass CAFTA. That's the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Guess what some of his reasons were.
Okay.
I'm walking down the street near the Capitol right now. Sorry for the noise.
That's quite all right.
Some of his reasons were that, in fact, it'll help the national security because these people will not be seeking jobs in the United States.
Because the jobs will go there.
That's right. They will be.
I'm sorry. Hey. Finish your sentence, Ellen. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
I mean, and that these people will now not come across our borders, and we will have trading relationships with them, and therefore it is good for the security of the United States, and that is why we need CAFTA.
Outsourcing will save us because it will stop illegal immigrants from coming into the United States who may represent a security threat to this country because they will be able to do our jobs down there instead of here.
And it will also raise their standard of living there, which we know NAFTA did not. And therefore, it will provide a much more secure hemisphere.
Well, in fact, when Mexico and Honduras and Nicaragua become richer than the United States, why would they want to come here? And we're actually heading down that road. I mean, George W. Bush has bankrupted us.
It's pretty unbelievable, but that is really where things are at. The other thing, of course, is that Senator Kennedy today was on the floor really excoriating them for putting this gun bill together as opposed to dealing with the defense of the United States and not getting that bill. And, of course, this is because they don't want to deal with the Lautenberg Amendment, which actually says that they have got to stop these multinational and national companies from having a loophole in terms of having subsidiaries deal with terrorist countries.
Oh, interesting. So the gun bill is tied up with...
No, the gun bill is going through instead of the defense bill.
Oh, I see. Okay, and the defense bill is being held up because Frank Lautenberg put an amendment in it that says
that's
that...
That's one of many, but that is one of the reasons it got held up, yes.
Interesting. And that says that if your company...
Because they can't get the cloture.
Yeah.
60 votes.
Yeah. Now, explain to us what cloture means. I have a feeling that's one of those words that...
They need 60 votes to get a bill to the floor to be voted on.
This is in the Senate.
This is in the Senate.
So they need to know that they're going to have those 60 votes, or they actually have to have a vote taken and 60 people have to vote on?
They have to have 60 people who come in and say, yes, I want to move this bill to the floor.
Now, that's called invoking cloture, is that right?
That is called invoking cloture, and you need 60 votes in order to do that.
Now, do sometimes people vote to invoke cloture and then vote against the bill?
Yes, many people have done that.
Oh, interesting. So then they can claim that they voted for the bill and then they voted against it?
Well, they can know. Pretty much then their final vote is actually what...
Cloture vote
is not considered one of their votes.
So some people would vote for cloture just to get the bill out there so that they could vote against it, so that they could be on the record of having defeated it.
That's correct.
Oh, that's fascinating. See, I learn something every day from you, Ellen.
That's exactly how the game works.
I thought cloture was a simple majority thing and that it was just, bring it out to the floor. I didn't realize that it took 60 votes.
And that, when you don't have cloture, then essentially you have a filibuster.
Yeah, in other words, the bill is not going to be voted on. It's not going to be brought to the floor of the Senate.
Exactly.
Now, what's the process for getting it out of committee to the point where a cloture vote can be taken?
Okay, out of committee is very simple. You need a simple majority on a committee. But the majority leaders, such as the Senate, decide how many people are going to be on the committee from each side.
I see. So Bill Frist and Harry Reid would have considerable say over, which bills are going to make their way out of committee, particularly Bill Frist, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, fascinating. Ellen, thanks so much for the update and for the civics lesson.
You're welcome.
Great to hear from you. We'll talk with you tomorrow. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. I'm Tom Harbin. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
Hey, I'm the old Bible Belt Bailey who you bamboozled them.
I did it so good, George.
Forget your AWOL and your DUI.
Yeah, we can just kind of overlook that.
You gave them a show that always pleases. Your friends claim you were endorsed by Jesus. You razzle-dazzled them, razzle-dazzled them, razzle-dazzled them, and made sane people cry.
Yeah! Welcome back, my friends. Just talking to the folks in the chat room. Interesting, having Dr. Jack Cassell on the program, and his booker had presented us with a conservative who was going to go on and talk about how important it is to never have socialized health care and keep the government out of medicine and totally privatize the health care system. And I don't know what happened. Did I change the guy's mind? Or did his booker not? You know, I'm mystified. Pleased, but mystified. I mean, it's always, if I did change his mind, then, hey, one more down. And on the other hand, you know, he seems like a decent guy. I mean, that's the thing. Most Americans, conservative, liberal, progressive, middle of the road, whatever, most Americans are decent people and really want the same. We all want the same things. We want our children to live in a better world than the world that we were born into. We want our children to have opportunities that are even better than the opportunities that we had. We want the air to be clean. We don't want people to be afraid of getting cancer from the food that they're eating or the water that they're drinking or the air that they're breathing. We want people to have access to a good education and opportunities. We want people to have the opportunity to start a business and earn an income and have a business that they can pass down in their family and you know, the entrepreneurial American dream. We all want that. This is very simple stuff. To be able to worship in the way that you choose. To be free from undue interference by the government. This is something that everybody agrees on. You know, how we get there, a little bit of disagreement. The cons say that the way you get there is you turn everything over to the multinational corporations and the politicians in their pockets, and they'll take care of it for you. And on the other hand, I would say, no, I think democracy in a constitutionally limited republic is a good idea. I think Jefferson actually figured it out fairly well, and Madison and Franklin and John Adams and a whole other topic. But in any case, that's it's interesting to see how it goes. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number, TomHartman.com. Of course, our website, if you want to drop into the chat room and say hi. Blue and Mo says, I think you did change his mind, Tom. Well, interesting. We'll find out. Urologist, he has a liquid mind, says Moondog. No, come on. Yeah, give me a break. So one of my best friends is a urologist. Good guy. It's a strange business, I can tell you that. KJ in Camas, Washington on the line. Hey, KJ, welcome to the program.
Yeah, nice job with Dr. Jack there. I think you did kind of change his heart a little bit.
Hopefully.
Yeah, a couple of issues I wanted to bring up. In your last hour, you mentioned that perhaps some of these neocons mean well because they feel that aristocracy is going to bring more social stability.
Well, that's what they've been saying for about 600 years.
Right, and yet in your...
With
your,
great consistency, by the way.
Right, and I'd like to point out to your listeners who have not read your book, What Would Jefferson Do?, and this was news to me, that no two democracies have ever gone to war against each other.
Right, in the history of the world.
So so obviously their aristocracy equals social stability. That argument doesn't fly.
No, and the reason why, in fact, there's a lot of social scientists trying to figure this out. Why have no two democracies ever gone to war with each other? And the reason, it turns out, is that when people actually hold the reins of power, as happens in a democracy, in a true representative democratic republic, where the people will not vote to send their own young men and women off to die for anything other than what they perceive to be their own self-defense and survival. That's it.
Yeah, and of course the people who have dragged us into this war, I don't know that any of their families are over there.
No, but they lied us into it. I mean, George W. Bush convinced us that there, or tried to convince us, now 51% of Americans today, the most recent connection, George W. Bush convinced us that, or as I said, tried to, that we were going to die these guys represented a real threat to us, that we were going to die if we didn't go to war. I mean, he was just, you know, pretty unambiguous about it, and therefore, you know, we got ourselves a war.
The other issue I wanted to bring up is maybe a little bit off track, but it seems to me there was one of these corporations that wanted to see our Constitution replaced with a biblical law.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
it's actually not a corporation. There's a family in the Midwest, and I'm not going to name them because they like to sue people. And they helped fund one of the major newspapers in the Midwest, and they also helped fund a company which started a voting machine company, which became the company that became the company that became one of the three largest voting machine companies in the United States right now.
But no doubt they're hyper-capitalist and very wealthy. Well, I was looking through the book of Exodus, and I found a couple of interesting passages. 22:25. If you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, do not be like a money lender. Charge him no interest.
Right, yeah, it's the same thing in Islam. In fact, the banks in the Middle East don't make their money on interest the way our banks do. They make their money on fees.
Yeah, I was here's another interesting one, 23:6. Do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuits.
Yeah. KJ, you're spot on, and I'll tell you, in fact, if you really want the mother load, if you're ever talking to a Christian in particular, it's these folks who call themselves Christians, read the 25th chapter of Matthew, the second parable in there, the parable of the sheep and the goats. It's the only place in the entire Bible where the disciples come to Jesus and they say, how do we get into heaven? And he says, well, you know, it's real simple. At the end of days, I'm going to be sitting here on a throne and separating the sheep from the goats, right? The sheep are going to go to heaven and the goats are going to go to hell. I'm going to say to them, you who fed me when I was hungry, you who gave me water when I was thirsty, you who visited me when I was in prison, you who clothed me when I was naked, you who took care of me when I was sick, you can come with me to heaven. And the disciples look around and they go, oh boy, we're screwed. We're in deep trouble here. Because, you know, you've never been hungry, so we haven't had a chance to feed you, and you've never been thirsty, so we haven't had a chance to give you water. You've never been in prison, so we haven't been able to visit you. How are we going to get into heaven? And they essentially said that. And Jesus says, as you've done unto the least of these among us, you have done unto me. And then he says to the goats, he says, and you who didn't take care of me when I was thirsty and hungry and poor and in prison, off to the eternal flames with you, because as you didn't do to the least among these, you didn't do to me. And that is, you know, sorry to sound like a preacher here, but I think it's important for, you know, since Christianity is becoming so much of the discourse in America, it's important to folks to understand that's the key, that's the core of Christianity, right there, the 25th chapter of Matthew, and it is absolutely antithetical to the Republican agenda. It's the opposite of it. And it's absolutely consistent with the historic way that America has looked at our social obligation to take care of the least among us. It's the New Deal, written by Jesus. So anyhow, enough of that rant. 1-866-889-8894. Jay in Arcata, California, listening on KGOE, I assume. Hey, Jay.
Hi, Tom. On your Washington report, Ellen said in passing she made a kind of a snide comment about the gun bill.
Yep.
And you've talked in the past about how people define one another. And I think the Republicans have managed to define all of the people who are in favor of the Second Amendment, and I include myself as one, as Republicans. And those people who are in favor of gun control are all Democrats. And conversely, all Democrats are in favor of gun control.
Well, first of all, that ain't true.
I know it ain't true. And I think we ought to make that very clear, that a lot of us are, I consider myself a Second Amendment liberal. And there are a lot of us out here in the West.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All over the United States, in fact. I tend to agree with Bernie Sanders on this, that this is an issue that first of all, there's, in fact, I don't want to put words in Bernie's mouth. I'll just tell you where I stand on this. That first of all, there's the issue of the difference between a device that can be used for self-defense or for hunting on the one hand and a weapon of war on the other hand. And if the founders wanted us to have weapons of war, if the real purpose of the Second Amendment was what Charlton Heston once said it was, which was that if the government ever becomes oppressive, the people will be armed and they can rise up against it. If that was really their intent, then the Second Amendment would have spoken to the state of the art of war at the time, which was cannons and warships. And it would have said the right of the people to organize into militias and have cannons and warships shall not be abridged. And it didn't say that. So, first of all, I think that weapons of war are things that should only be held by armies, you know, period. And so, you know, if something's a weapon of war, it's not something that should be widely available. Now, you know, they can still be used as a toy. I mean, you know, I lived in Atlanta years ago, and I remember, you know, my son was curious about guns and machine. We went down to a shooting range and fired off an Uzi and a you know, Heckler and even it was a bunch of them anyhow. It was great fun. It was toys for boys, right?
Exactly.
But I wasn't trying to own one of these things. On the other hand, with regard to weapons for hunting and for self-protection, I think every community should have the right to establish their own standards.
Amen.
And I realize that, you know, there's a lot of progressives and liberals who disagree with me on that, but I think that, frankly, the needs or the desires or whatever of somebody who lives in rural Vermont or rural Oregon or whatever, Wyoming, are very different from somebody who lives in Manhattan. And I can understand where people in Manhattan would say, hey, you know, you can't, there's nothing to hunt here. There's no game here in Manhattan. And so we're not going to allow there to be, you can't have a deer rifle here.
Right.
And, you know, and you know, whether or not people can have weapons for self-defense, we're going to put really tight limits on it. And you can get a carry license if you can prove that you can be responsible with a gun. That makes sense to me in Manhattan. I'm not sure it makes sense in rural Vermont.
Right.
But, so,
you know, the thing is, I remember trying to talk one fellow into voting as a Democrat, and he said, I won't vote for a Democrat. They're trying to take my guns away. And Republicans
have put
that idea out there, and it's got to be fought.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, in fact, I suspect that, you know, what I just described, I mean, my general position on gun control and all of this is probably held by the majority of Democrats, you know, rather than some sort of knee-jerk gun control thing. You know, it's interesting, as Michael Moore pointed out in Bowling for Columbine, in Canada, they have more guns per capita than in the United States. There are more guns out there in Canada on a per-person basis than in the United States, and yet they have like a thousandth of the crime that we have, of the gun crime that we have in the United States. We have a gun problem in the United States. It is a big gun problem, and it's being promoted by the weapons manufacturers and the gun shows and all these unregulated trade in essentially what are weapons of war. But we have a larger problem, and that's our cultural problem.
Right, and the murder problem.
Yeah, and that's something that needs to be addressed in a different level.
But gun control never works because the people who should give them up won't give them up.
Yeah, it's like trying to criminalize alcohol or pot or anything else. Jay, thanks for the call.
Good work.
Yeah, good talking to you. 1-866-889-8894. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to talk about CAFTA.
Okay.
And I was wondering, I remember all those promises that we wouldn't get illegal immigrants whenever they put NAFTA through.
Yeah.
And remember Gore, he went ahead and did the deciding vote where he broke the tie for NAFTA. And I was just wondering if Hillary voted for it. Do you know?
Hillary was not in office when NAFTA was passed. She was the wife
of... I'm sorry, not NAFTA, I'm sorry, CAFTA.
CAFTA. You know, I don't know. I don't have the voting record right in front of me. I would be surprised if she hadn't, frankly.
Yeah.
But I don't. But I shouldn't say that with any certainty, because I remember that there were several people who voted against CAFTA that surprised me. And then there were a few people who voted in favor of it, like the Democrat Ron Wyden of Oregon, my senator here, who voted in favor of it. And that's Jim Jeffords in Vermont, who voted in favor of it. And that surprised me. So, I just don't know. I'm sorry.
New York is the ultimate money changer state, and that, you know, all these agreements help the money changers.
Sure.
And also Codex, where I don't want the government telling me I can't take therapeutic levels of certain supplements.
Yes, what you're talking to is referred to, I believe, as the Codex Alimentarius or something like that.
Right.
And this is the international set of standards of vitamins and food supplements and herbs that basically says that if you want to take vitamins, you want to take herbs, you have to buy them from a pharmaceutical company, you have to have a prescription from a doctor. And just a few weeks ago, the European Union ruled in the High Court of the European Union in Belgium that was the law in Europe, and it's still being fought there. And there are some people, Article 3 of CAFTA, says that the United States will harmonize its food laws to those of international standards. And because the Codex is part of the food laws, there's a lot of people very concerned about this.
Yes,
and
right.
Frankly, the weird one, and the one that you should call, is Henry Waxman. Henry Waxman mm-hmm. is a brilliant progressive and one of the finest men in the United States House of Representatives.
From what state is he?
He's from California. And he's a person who has my absolute and undying respect and admiration, except that Henry Waxman thinks that herbs and vitamins should be made illegal and put into the province of the drug companies. And I think that people need to be calling 1-877 toll-free, 1-877-SOB-USOB, the toll-free number for Congress, and telling Henry Waxman, hey, Henry, get with the program. We want our vitamins.
And, Tom, people need to know that it's entirely okay if they don't live in his district, because the big corporations, they don't care what district they're from. They knock on everybody's door. You are more important than a corporate piece of paper.
That's right.
Isn't really a human being.
Yeah, and this is one of those funny areas where it's not a liberal or conservative issue. I mean, Henry Waxman is a very progressive Democrat. On the other hand, you've got some conservatives like Orrin Hatch from Utah, where there's a big herb industry among the Mormons, and Ron Paul from Texas, a very, very conservative member of the House of Representatives, who are strongly in favor of leaving herbs and vitamins as, you know, absolutely free, open marketplace, and like that. In fact, you would think that a free market conservative would be in favor of them. It just completely crosses the lines in very confusing ways. And so,
well, I wonder if Pat Robertson and those kinds of people are speaking up against it. I doubt it. But they're very big proponents. All the Christian stations, we have one here in Pittsburgh, for instance, they always have programs about it. But I doubt very much if they would go against Bush.
No, I doubt they're going against Bush, but they are speaking out in favor of vitamins, and particularly the Mormons, because some absolutely huge Mormon companies are making big bucks on vitamins, and it's a big business within the Mormon community. But, you know, it's just interesting to see how interests, you know, cross currents and all that sort of thing. Bonnie, thanks a lot for the call. It's nice to hear from you, and thank you for listening. I'm assuming on WPTT there in Pittsburgh. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Talk radio for the rest of us. You're in the real free speech zone. No barbed wire here. No pass from the RNC required either. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Welcome back, my friends. Good old Van Morrison, one of the true geniuses in the music industry. Welcome back. Pleased to be with you, Tom Hartman. In fact, I used to have Moondance. It was the theme song for a radio program I did 30 years ago. Long ago and far away, shall we say. Anyhow, I'm dating myself here. Matt in Arlington, Texas on the line. Oh, by the way, I wanted to mention in the chat room, one of the folks in the chat room, I think it was Latir, I'm not sure. Anyhow, one of the folks in the chat room said Hillary Clinton did not vote for CAFTA. She voted against it and provided us with a link. We were able to check it out. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom, your previous guest reminds me of the guy in his workshop where the light power goes out throughout the city and he goes, oops, I got to change the light bulb.
Ha!
I got two dentists in my family who kind of have the same approach. You're so holistic about stuff, and you get these people on, well, I was poking in this little corner over here, and, well, this is the problem. No, stand back and look at the whole picture. I don't think you convinced him as so much as you kind of made his frame change a bit and made him look at that he wasn't paying any attention to and didn't research his book.
Yeah, I think so. But, I mean, this is a guy that they've, you know, one of these conservative think tanks is putting out there as an expert on this stuff.
Really?
Yeah, I'm serious. I'm not kidding you. I mean, we just didn't pull it. This guy's a doctor down in Florida. I didn't just pull him out of the air. You know,
Well, say it. I mean, the guy's a third stringer. I really wish you could get
Evan actually
with a brain on your show.
Yeah, well, it's if I could get Karl Rove on, that'd be a hoot, wouldn't it? Evan Say It actually is pretty well thought of in the conservative community. It's just for better or for worse. And there you go. Well said. But, you know, I want to give Evan credit, by the way, because he's willing to come back on this program week after week and get beat up. And occasionally, maybe we can even change his mind. I mean, I think that there's a real person underneath all that stuff. So we'll see, you know, as time goes on. But anyhow, Matt, thanks a lot for the call and for your kind words. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. Yeah, It really is quite remarkable. By the way, Jessica Simpson, just to show you how culturally ignorant I am, or what a geek I am, I thought for a long time Jessica Simpson was Homer and Marge's daughter. Anyhow, Jessica Simpson wants to know where missing footage of her and husband Nick's harrowing trip to Iraq went to. They went to Iraq. They saw that it was horrific, horrible, terrible. They brought all back all his footage, and none of it appeared in their fun-filled TV show. She says, it's unbelievable. They didn't show a lot of what really went on with the enemy attacks and the shelling. There was so much stuff that went on, and somehow the tapes got mysteriously misplaced. Yeah, that happens a lot when George Bush is in office. It's just, you know, one of those funny things. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to Scott Forrester for engineering the program, to Louise for producing it, to you, the folks in our chat room for showing up, and to you. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.